thank you everyone for coming today to press conference to announce the protest on the 50th anniversary of the 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention here in Chicago. My name is Andy Thayer, A-N-D-Y-T-H-A-Y-E-R. I'm with the Chicago Committee Against War and Racism, as are a number of our speakers behind me here. Chicago 1968, the protests against it, played a pivotal role in the anti-war movement. It was a time when people learned that neither political party, the major parties, were going to stop what was at that time America's longest running war. It was a time when people realized that our mayor exercised near dictatorial authority in the city of Chicago to the point where his police felt that they had carte blanche to carry out violence against nonviolent demonstrators. And we have to say to ourselves, is this merely of historical importance, or do the events of 1968 here in our own city carry a lesson for today? And our answer is an emphatic yes. We live in a city which is reeling still from the violence of our police officers in the Laquan McDonald murder, with a trial coming up in just a couple of months. We are living in a country where our schools, where all of our resources that could be helping our young people, are deprived because we are spending as much on war as practically the entire rest of the world combined. Now, our speakers are going to talk in more depth about that, and I will give it up to them. I should just note that we have succeeded in getting a permit to march in the streets on August 25th. The protest is going to begin at Richard J. Daley Plaza, appropriately enough, and circle City Hall, going past the Cook County Democratic Party headquarters, and then heading down here to the John Logan statue, scene of the most iconic protests of 1968. So with that, I'm going to give it up to our first speaker, Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence.
Thank you, Andy. My name is Kathy Kelly, K-A-T-H-Y-K-E-L-L-Y. I'm part of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. We're a group that believes that where you stand determines what you see. And we've tried to stand alongside people who are trapped in various war zones, who aren't able to get out. And I have to say, I have to wonder myself, what justice is there that I have the blue passport, that I have freedom of movement? And we've had a history of savagery in our militarism and in our racism that has caused so much displacement, despair, death, and destruction. I just recently returned from Afghanistan. Even where I stayed, the well had dried up. People are desperate because of drought, because of lack of resources, because of unemployment, because of constant bombing. Kabul has now become the most dangerous place in Afghanistan. And our young friends say to us, tell the people in your country, don't send your sons and daughters over here. It's dangerous for them, and it doesn't accomplish any good. I have in my hand a book by David Dellinger, From Yale to Jail. And Dave Dellinger was a truly heroic figure in Chicago and throughout his life, I believe. And he's somebody who soundly condemned every war, every act of violence. But he also said that we do have a responsibility to, in all of our actions, reflect the kinds of relationships we really do want to see. And so it's a privilege to have Dave Dellinger's mentorship and the history of what happened in Chicago to give us lots to think about and work toward today.
Thank you. Our next speaker will be Natasha Erskine, who is with Veterans for Peace, is a Chicago public school mom, and she's going to tell us why she is going to be supporting the demonstration.
Absolutely. Good afternoon. My name is Natasha, N-A-T-A-S-H-A, Erskine, E-R-S-K-I-N-E. I am the deputy coordinator for Veterans for Peace Chicago. I'm a 20-year Air Force veteran. I am here because I participated in campaigns. I took tours of duty that definitely conflicted with my moral interests. And when I talk about these things across the city, particularly at the Chicago Public School board meetings, because what I'm trying to get them to move away from is the militarization of our schools. And with that, I mean the Junior ROTC program, which houses over 90% of Black and Latinx students, right? And we know that anything that is great should be a little bit more diverse than that, right? We know that there are schools on the north side and in more affluent areas that include language and opportunity, right? While our schools get a junior military academy and training. And what I feel about that is, being that I felt like I was recruited out of JROTC and Chicago Public Schools as well, I know that it's also a recruitment tool. And so when we talk about the anti-war movement, I feel very strongly that it has to start with the school system that is recruiting our youths and indoctrinating families as well into believing that a war economy is somehow patriotic. I spent 20 years, I have decorations, I have a military record that tells you that I participated in it. So I feel like it was my duty when I came home to come back and educate my community that that is not the answer. Our students deserve art. They deserve physical education. They deserve a full educational opportunity that we know our neighbors do. And so when we talk about, like, why is it important to be involved in an anti-war movement? Because it starts with our youth, right? So when I go into some of these classrooms and I'm able to give young folks an opportunity or a counter narrative in terms of why it's important to not sign on that dotted line, to not enlist after you finish high school. And it goes back to the lessons that we learned in 1968. Those things have not changed. They've actually gotten worse in ways. We know that this government spends 63 cents on the dollar on the war economy. While there are people who I see sleeping on the bench, I see people struggling with many insecurities, housing, food, a quality of life. Right? And we know that that cannot be so while this nation spends all of its money abroad on the war. Some of those times, and I can just tell you about a particular program that I was, it was considered a feather in the cap for me to team with Defense Logistics Agency and many of the corporations that we see, Bell, Boeing, Helicopter, where we purchased thousands of mine-resistant, ambush-proof, the MRAP vehicles. Some of the vehicles that you see when the Chicago police show up, right, it's a up-armored vehicle that was designed for the battlefield that now house the police department and their SWAT teams. So when we talk about, like, what is militarization, I look at that when it's at a home on the home front. I look at it what it looks like when it's rolling down my street and your street, and I know that it's not right. So my tie to 1968 to 2016 is that not much has changed. In a lot of ways, things have gotten worse. There is no room for expansion of militarization. There is no room for the expansion of racism that is unchecked in the military that I also experienced when I was stationed in the Air Force Special Operations Command and other commands. But when we talk about, like, what are the things that it were that Black and marginalized folks were struggling with in 1968, I don't see how that has changed now. So my pull is to say that I resonate with 1968, and I'm a product of this war economy by nature of my service. And when I talk about, like, why is it important for us to have these conversations and to show up when we can put our voice and our experience to these causes, I think it's incredibly important so that we know that the battlefield is also responsible for the things like proliferation of gun violence. So when I talk about schools and we talk about educating of young folks, when we talk about poverty, we know that that's because our nation spends too much on the war economy. And then when we talk about the moral authority, if you will, in terms of going across these borders to the wars and bringing that home, we want to have, like, a deep conversation and understanding. So what I'm looking forward to on August 25th when we go to this rally is to have some more speak outs and bring veterans to this space so we can have a real credible conversation and lesson learned, and not just commemorate what happened in 1968, but bridge the gap and understand that together we can help change the fabric of this nation. Thank you.
Thank you, Natasha. Next, we will have Victoria Cervantes of La Voz de los de Bajo. Victoria has led innumerable delegations to Central America, visiting and leading delegations to Colombia, to Honduras, to Venezuela, and Mexico. Her biography, in terms of seeing the direct effects of U.S. foreign policy, in terms of enabling dictators, enabling violence against the peoples of the region, is extensive. Let's welcome Victi Cervantes.
For Latin America, you can't just say 68 without talking about 68 as the uprising in Mexico, in which hundreds of activists were murdered by a government supported by the U.S. You can't say 1970 without talking about Allende in Chile, who was elected as part of a resistance to the U.S. interference and economic policies, and who was overthrown in a violent coup in 1973, a coup organized, funded, supported by the U.S. and the U.S. military. You can't say 1970s in Latin America without thinking of the uprisings of the people in Central America trying to implement sovereignty, trying to get out from under the U.S. that was met by one of the most violent civil wars across the Northern Triangle in the history of Latin America, in which hundreds of thousands of people were killed or disappeared, supported by U.S. policy. This is U.S. policy, and it continues to the present. It's a policy that combines militarization, integration of police and military together as a repressive arm, privatization, destruction of the economies, destruction of the democratic institutions, repression, and it's what has created the refugee crisis that we are seeing now as thousands of children, families, ordinary working people are pouring out of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras as a direct result of U.S. policy. And I say refugees because they are refugees of a war against democracy, a war against sovereignty of the people in Central America. I just got back from Honduras early May from another delegation in which I saw in the streets of Honduras the special U.S.-created, trained, and vetted police force called, of all things, the Tigers. Right away, you get the feeling that maybe they don't have much to do with keeping the peace. Los Tigres. The Tigers, Los Tigres, have been implicated in repression. They have been implicated in the street violence against protesters during the electoral crisis from the fraudulent election in November. And they, along with the military police, the national police, the local police, and even the transit police, are part of a system created for ongoing violence against the people. And this system is backed up 100% by the U.S. government. 100%. But you also can't say 68 and 70s and 80s in Latin America without recognizing the strength of the people's resistance, the social movements, the unions, the campesinos, the indigenous people. And in Honduras, as well as in other countries, that's continuing as we speak. Today, there's a transportation strike protesting the violence against the taxi drivers, the truck drivers, the skyrocketing costs of fuel, and the government repression. That transit strike was attacked last night and this morning by the same integrated security forces that I mentioned, tear gassed, and people are being beaten into the streets. This is the reality in Honduras. This is the reality in Latin America. And my organizations are supporting the protest on August 25th because we see that as the same fight that's going on here in Chicago. We see that we here in the United States must stand up and say no more, no more. Thank you.
Thank you, Victi. Our next speaker is Vince Emanuel, who is a nationally recognized anti-war activist. He served two terms in Iraq. Let's welcome Vince.
Hello, my name is Vincent Emanuele, V-I-N-C-E-N-T-E-M-A-N-U-E-L-E. Since 9/11, the United States has bombed seven nations: Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, Syria, and Somalia. As a result, more than 1.5 to 2 million people have died, and tens of millions of people were displaced, contributing to not only the Syrian civil war, but also the greatest refugee crisis since World War II. In Iraq, the U.S. military killed innocent people, destroyed mosques, schools, and businesses. U.S. troops mutilated dead bodies, took pictures with prisoners and corpses, and tortured Iraqi civilians. Without question, ISIS is a byproduct of those actions, not an inevitable manifestation of Islam, as many xenophobic people claim. Back in 2008, myself, along with eight other veterans, testified to U.S. Congress about war crimes, atrocities, and military culture. At the time, however, very few people cared to think or talk about the past. At the time, Senator Barack Obama was the Democratic Party nominee, and liberals were convinced that he would bring an end to the endless wars. Unfortunately, they were incorrect. President Obama and the Democratic Party not only continued Bush's insane and immoral war on terror, they escalated many aspects of it, from increased drone strikes to expanded surveillance and covert operations. Remember, Barack Obama's first major foreign policy decision was to escalate the war in Afghanistan, sending another 35,000 troops to what is now the longest war in U.S. history. Unfortunately, none of this is new. The U.S. has been bombing and occupying countries and overthrowing democratically elected governments for decades, in fact, well over a century. 50 years ago, in this very city, on these very streets, students, communities of color, union workers such as my father, and anti-war veterans, led by Vietnam Veterans Against the War, a group that was once 35,000 strong, marched to end the Vietnam War, and they were met with police brutality and violence. Today, the police are fully militarized. They now enjoy the same weapons, equipment, and capacities as highly trained special forces military units. We must, however, view drone strikes, police violence, wars, covert operations, the military-industrial complex, and the prison-industrial complex, and the war on drugs as part of a larger problem in U.S. society, and that is U.S. empire and U.S. militarism. The U.S. has 5% of the world's population, but accounts for 33% of the world's military expenditures. The U.S. is also the largest exporter of arms and munitions around the world. The U.S. maintains a military empire of 800 bases scattered across 80 countries. And since 9/11, according to Brown University, the U.S. has spent $5.6 trillion on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Today, the Trump administration, with the GOP leading the way and the Democratic Party providing no meaningful opposition, is cutting taxes for the 1%, bolstering the military budget, while cutting social services for the very people who fight Uncle Sam's wars. Poor and working class Americans, disproportionately people of color. As Dr. Martin Luther King once said 50 years ago, every bomb that drops on the in Vietnam explodes in the streets of the United States. For every bomb that's dropped, someone in the U.S. goes without healthcare, housing, food, or shelter. Continuing the work of the 1968 generation, and in solidarity with those who marched on these very streets 50 years ago, we say enough is enough. If the U.S. has money always for an endless war, the U.S. has money to take care of people here and the people around the world whose lives and countries we've destroyed. So the Chicago Committee Against War and Racism not only says dismantle the U.S. empire and demilitarize the police, but invest in our communities because we need it now.
Okay, and our final speaker before we open it up for questions is Rich Whitney. Rich initiated this whole process back in December to hold a protest on the 50th anniversary of the Democratic Convention here in Chicago. And that is not only to his credit, he's also a co-founder of the Chicago Committee Against War and Racism. He is a leader in the United National Anti-War Coalition, and he's also co-chair of the Illinois Green Party. Let's give it up for Rich.
Thank you, Andy. Good afternoon. My name is Rich Whitney, R-I-C-H-W-H-I-T-N-E-Y. In calling for this demonstration, the Chicago Committee Against War and Racism declares that, as one of our other speakers reminded us, in many respects, we are confronting worse evils, than we were 50 years ago, but we are still confronting the same institutional barriers to peace and progress. Just 11 days ago, U.S.-led coalition warplanes in Syria conducted intensive airstrikes near Abu Kamal and the Deir el-Zor province, with estimates of civilian casualties ranging from 30 to 54, the higher estimate coming from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. All too typically, these kinds of attacks receive too little media attention, and they're not being part of the so-called national conversation. But acts like these, occurring on a regular basis, need to become part of the national conversation. And that is part of what motivates us to call for this protest. These acts of aggressive war are not somehow magically transformed into moral acts simply because relatively few U.S. personnel are now at risk of harm. In 1968, the U.S. government was engaged in one illegal war. Now, the U.S. illegally bombs, drone strikes, and/or occupies territory in seven different countries, as Vince just pointed out a moment ago. It is responsible for millions of casualties, horrific devastation and suffering, and the displacement of millions of refugees. It has also been financing covert destabilization, so-called regime change, and support for repressive governments in much of Central and South America. And then it cruelly imprisons and punishes the hundreds of thousands of refugees who come to this country seeking safety and an opportunity to work. It spends $10.3 million a day of our tax dollars in military support of a repressive and now officially apartheid government in Israel. Every single one of these attacks on other nations are illegal under established international law, including the Kellogg-Briand Pact, the Nuremberg Charter that our nation once championed after World War II, and the United Nations Charter. As in 1968, we still have no right to attack other nations that never attacked us. Let us be clear. These wars are not only thoroughly immoral and illegal in their direct impacts, they are also part of a war against at home against the American working class and especially its most oppressed members, people in communities of color. We spend over $1.3 trillion a year on war and maintaining a military machine, including about 1,000 military bases in 135 different countries, while working people and students are driven into poverty and debt, and while millions of people go without access to health care, decent schools, decent and affordable housing, safe drinking water, higher education, decent public transportation, and other necessities. And our government spends these colossal sums on what amounts to corporate welfare to help ensure continued profits of giant energy corporations, weapons manufacturers, and others, all to maintain an empire and continue policies of global domination that ultimately make us less safe, not more safe. Today's peace movement is not as visible and large as it was in the late 1960s and early 70s, but in one sense, in some respects, it is a little bit ahead of where we were in 1968. We now have a clear understanding that, as in 1968, these policies are the product of a bipartisan consensus. The Democratic Party leadership, as other speakers have noted, is every bit as supportive of illegal wars and interventions as it was in 1968. Its members in Congress regularly vote with their Republican colleagues to fund these wars and a foreign policy motivated by domination. Instead of a system of checks and balances, they mainly just write the checks. As in 1968, its leaders stifle those who support more progressive candidates, witness 2016. The party and its Chicago machine remain entrenched supporters of an unjust system, protecting corporate profits and power no less than their Republican counterparts. More than in 1968, we have a clear understanding that the issues of war abroad and the struggles against racism, police violence, privation, and poverty at home are all related. They are one struggle. Today, we all understand that all of these evils are rooted in a class-ruled economic system in which the dominant class uses its wealth and power to control the political process, buy political results, and advance its inhumane agenda. Today's anti-war movement will assert its right to use peaceful legal protest, but we also understand that we must organize against the institutions that generate war and racism and not just protest their effects. Some of us may be from that generation, but this is not your grandparents' peace movement. Thank you.
This year marks not only the 50th anniversary of the Democratic Convention in Chicago, it's also the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, the expulsion of Palestinians from the 68 borders of, I should say, the 48 borders of Israel. Our speaker from the Palestinian community could not join us today, but that bears noting, if for no other reason, that as we speak right now, one of the worst bombardments, probably the worst bombardment in a half decade, is occurring against Gaza. And yet war has become so normalized in our culture, in our society, that there's barely any mention of that, let alone any number of the other wars that our speakers mentioned. This event on August 25th is not going to be about nostalgia. It's going to be how we can make our society better. 50 years ago, we faced a pivotal event in the movement that, for the first time in U.S. history, stopped a war before the exhaustion of one or more parties fighting it. That, if for no other reason, is a reason why we should hearken back to 68 to learn the lessons to apply to today. And we know that our mayor, no more than the mayor back in 1968, will not be carrying forth those lessons. And so this movement, which will be demonstrating right here on Saturday, August 25th, will be bringing forth the messages that you just heard. And with that, I'd like to invite our speakers to come up, and if you folks have got questions, please fire away. It's very simple. 50 years ago, in what happened here in Chicago, taught the anti-war movement a lesson that we could not depend on either major party to stop the wars. That in fact, they were so hell-bent on pushing these wars that they would crack heads in order to continue fighting those wars. And then the anti-war movement drew on its own resources. And I'm not talking just about the civilians in the streets. I'm talking about people within the armed forces who became another front in that anti-war movement, as well as, of course, the efforts of Southeast Asians themselves. It was the people that stopped the wars, not either major party. We can look at Donald Trump and look at how barbaric, how racist, how nasty in every respect he is. But as some of our speakers mentioned, the Democrats have been applauding when he, for example, bombs Syria. They've been demanding even stricter attacks on North Korea and others. They've been not on the side of peace any more than the current resident of the White House is. And so while the Democratic Party here in Chicago and nationally will be pointing to themselves as the answer to Donald Trump and all that he represents, our point is that Chicago 68 showed that any social progress really depends on the people themselves and not on either major party.
Alternative vision to this society's current structure of making money off of death and destruction, which comes back home in what's been mentioned, the scope of the neglect.
Well, I mean, I would just say, and I'd invite our other speakers to address this as well. Yeah, I mean, why don't we go ahead.
Well, I think Natasha eloquently spoke about that and the impact on schools at home. The only point I just wanted to mention to amplify something that Andy just said in answering the prior question is that our current senators in this state, Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth, both voted in favor of the increase to the defense appropriation, the $80 billion increase for the current fiscal year. That's what I mean by writing the blank checks. Think we couldn't better use $80 billion here in this city for public schools, for health care, for higher education, which is being starved in this state right now? You bet we could.
I think the greatest terror we all face is the terror of what we're doing to our own environment. There are people all around the world who don't have a chance to speak up with regard to United States savagery that costs them their lives and their livelihoods. But we could solve world hunger. We could end many, many diseases. We could make sure every child from every school in the United States can graduate from a university without any debt whatsoever. We could do it all. We can't do any of it as long as the demonic suction cup of the United States military keeps robbing the resources, robbing the wealth, robbing the ingenuity and the problem-solving capacities of people in this country. We have to keep saying it. I mean, even if we all think, well, we're not really going to succeed, impotence is never an excuse for inaction. Thank you.
And I have one more question, since it was brought up that currently the state of Israel is brutalizing to the extreme the people in Palestine, the Palestinians. Can you address the link between the militarism here that supports the militarism expansion and what would have to be characterized as war crimes if the truth be told by a failed state? No other state could do that, what they're doing there, and continue to exist. They'd be bombed by the surrounding country. Can somebody address that?
One thing comes to mind right away, and that is the fact that the original sin of American imperialism lies in the fact that we invaded the land of the First Nations people. We're on their territory right now as we speak. And obviously you see something very comparable has happened in Palestine. It's basically, it is an act of imperial domination and occupation, taking over someone's land. So there's a direct parallel right there.
Well, just the Chicago Police Department has had a long-ranging exchange program with various paramilitary forces in Israel to get training to deal with us here as they deal with Palestinians in the occupied territories. And it goes beyond that. Facial recognition technology, I'm told by people who know more about this, has been expanded and studied heavily in Israel. And those technologies are being rolled out in places not only like China, but our own CPD has wanted to use those same technologies to surveil here in the United States. So the connections are innumerable. Arguably, the nuclear weapons that Israel has got today came about as a result of sharing that technology from the United States. And yet the United States goes around the world, being the only country that's ever dropped nuclear bombs on anyone else, goes around the world dictating what other countries can use to arm themselves. Now, I'm against all nuclear weapons, but we at the very least here in the United States have got to recognize this rank hypocrisy, this threatening of war, for example, against Iran, which had a deal with the United States about at least checking the development of nuclear weapons. And that's now being all thrown out. And as you see some of our speakers here, are unfortunately forced to wear hands-off Iran buttons because the threat against of war against Iran is very real. Well, we're revived what used to be known as the Chicago Coalition Against War and Racism, which was formed just a few days after 9/11 to respond to not only the then impending U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, but also the series of attacks on Arabs, Muslims, and people perceived to be such here in the city of Chicago. There was a church, a Syrian-American church, that the racists somehow figured must be Muslim in some respect. I mean, racists aren't known for being particularly bright. That was just a half block away from my apartment as of a few weeks ago that was firebombed. The Arab-American Community Center was torched to the ground here in the city of Chicago just days after 9/11. CCAWR formed as a result of those events and opposed the then invasion of Afghanistan, even though it was incredibly unpopular to do so at that time. We also opposed the launch of the invasion of Iraq, and I'm proud to say we led 10,000 plus people onto Lakeshore Drive in an unpermitted march against the start of that war on the evening of March 20th, 2003. And to bring things full circle in terms of being against police misconduct, later that evening was the largest mass arrest in Chicago history of those demonstrators, and all the charges were dropped in a manner indicative of innocence. And so the connections between police brutality and misconduct and wars abroad, I think, are far deeper than many people realize, and it's seen in the history of CCAWR.
So who are you? What's your membership?
Yeah, we just recently reformed as a committee a handful of weeks ago because we thought that the lessons of 1968 in the Chicago Democratic Convention were far too valuable to be left to the mayor and his press office alone. So we're literally just restarting. The anti-war movement went into quiescence for several years there, particularly during the Obama years, which is something that I think all of us oppose. We thought the anti-war movement was just as necessary under Republican presidents as under Democratic presidents. So we're restarting this, and it doesn't matter what happens in 2020 or 2018. We need an independent anti-war movement, and that's why we restarted just a few weeks ago the Chicago Committee Against War and Racism. We invite all organizations that are genuinely interested in these issues to join in this protest. This is not just about ourselves. We have speakers here who aren't formerly members of CCAWR, as I said. We just started.
Thank you.
Thank you.